We might get started then. My name is Peter Larson. I'll be the chair for this session today, and talking about our direct channels helping life insurers and consumers to address underinsurance by Wayne Kenefack and John King. I'll just go through quickly through the bios. John is a manager in the financial services team at Deloitte, actuaries and consultants. He has experience in product design, pricing of insurance products, specialing in consumer credit insurance and products tailored for the direct channel. He's originally from Ireland, but in 2006 he decided to come to Australia for a few years, and he's still here today. Wayne spent the second half of the 2000s establishing, growing and running an actuarial function for St Andrews, Australia. St Andrews was a young and fast-growing life company, life insurance, general insurance and wealth management operation owned by HBOS Australia. In 2008, CBA purchased St Andrews and commenced integrating the business into Common Shore and Colonial First State. In March this year, CBA announced the sale of St Andrews insurance operations to the Bank of Queensland. Wayne is now looking forward to re-establishing, growing and running the actuarial function of St Andrews once again after completion of the sale. Prior to St Andrews, you worked as a consulting actuary for Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants in the life, wealth and banking sectors.
Thanks, Peter, for that introduction. It's a long question, and I thought an interesting one. It's not a question that we're going to definitively answer, though. So if anyone's looking for John and I to have gone and done a whole bunch of research and come up with a quantitative answer to this question, sorry, please leave now. What we are presenting today, clearly we've done quite a lot of research, and we did write a paper on this topic. It's not just a presentation, so if you are interested, please go away and read the paper later. I know a few of you have read it already, and I'm very gratified that somebody has read it. But it is it's a paper. It's more opinion than research. It is the opinion of the authors, and I should point out it's our opinion, it's not the opinions of our various employers. Hopefully, what it will do is be a little bit contentious and provide a good platform for the discussion later on in the session. Before I move on, thanks very much, Peter, for stepping in at the very last minute. I know that you weren't going to chair this yesterday and you are now, so thank you. Thanks also to James Sickey for his peer review. I sent we've got an awful lot of anecdotal evidence in this paper. You'll note if you've read through the paper or as you go through, because lots of things that aren't particularly credited. I thanked the people who provided that anonymously via email last night. So if you're any of you in the room, thank you. I'm just going to do the overview slide in here, and I'll actually hand over to John to present the first half of the paper. What we're really aiming to do here, so we've broken the question down nice and actuarially into looking at, well, what's the context for the question, and then we'll go and answer the question once we've discussed the context. So the first probably half a dozen or so, maybe a few more slides, looks at actually what is the direct market. Firstly, obviously here, defining under insurance, then discusses the current state of the direct life insurance market. What are the types of channels? What is it we actually mean by direct? As far as I'm concerned, we define it into about six sub-channels, if you like, and different ways in which you can go direct. And certainly John will take you through all that. Once John has taken you through that and some international experience, I'll come up and try to... Sorry. I've just gone to the end. I'll actually try to answer the question, which is, do the direct markets address underinsurance, both from an insurer's perspective? Are they actually helping life insurers to access new customers or to access customers more profitably? And are they helping the consumers? If I am, can I, as a naive consumer, go out and meet my life insurance needs without speaking to an advisor? And how easily can I do that? So I'll hand over to John to take us through the first few slides.
Thanks a lot for coming today. So maybe just to begin, if we're going to talk about underinsurance and direct channels, it makes sense just to start with underinsurance. I think we're probably all fairly familiar with the term. It's very often referenced in the media. So it's no real surprise to anybody who's a participant in the insurance industry. IFSA research has, IFSA have done some research in this, and they have an initiative, the LifeWise initiative, where they're trying to promote insurance in the general population. They've stated that 55% of the Australian population only 55% have life insurance cover, which, to be honest, doesn't really sound like it's enough for people, is it? And it's even worse when you look at income and disability cover, where only 30% of the population have some form of cover. When you compare this to the GI space, where people quite readily insure their car or their house, one statistic I found was that 83% of people are insuring their car. I think there's a bit of a mismatch here when people are valuing their car more than their life or their income. So something probably has to be done about it. Most of the insurance that actually arises tends to be from the superannuation, and people generally aren't doing anything about it, whether they're not speaking to a financial advisor, and they're obviously not doing anything about it themselves, or sorry, I shouldn't say they're not all doing it, but there's not enough of them, so we need to promote that. There's further questions, not just about how many people actually have insurance, but do they even have enough insurance for those that are actually taking out insurance? So the adequacy of this cover is actually quite important. Through the superannuation, the most life cover normally only covers about 20% of their needs. So we really need to bring that up again. And if superannuation isn't doing it through the default channel, maybe there's more opportunities within the direct market. Compared to GI, where asset values or the affordability of insurance is quite similar, they seem to have a much higher rate of take up. So price probably isn't the only issue that makes insurance unattractive from taking it up. IFSA have also quantified this as a gap of $1.4 trillion. So there's plenty of scope to expand and to fill that gap. Now, if we try and talk about what actually under insurance from Australia versus the rest of the world, I'm not sure if you can see that. It's probably a little bit small. But Swiss Re did a study a little while ago, and they've tried to quantify underinsurance by comparing the insurance premium as a percentage of the GDP of that country. The top five countries all had, let's say, an insurance penetration rate of between 9% and 13%, and Australia came in about 20th with a penetration of only 3.8%. So even by an international standard, there's definitely a shortfall in the Australian market compared to other standards. That's not to say that 9% or 13% is enough, but it's definitely the 3.8% of Australia is below what it needs to be, I think. So are direct channels the answer to renovating the financial system or to solving this problem? And that's what we're going to try and look at. I think it makes sense, first of all, just to talk about what are direct channels. From our point of view, we're defining this as where individual policies are sold without the involvement of a financial advisor or a planner that is accredited to provide full advice. Probably slightly more broad than what people might think is direct insurance. Most importantly, we're including sales through direct but no advice. So, for example, if you go into a bank and there's a flyer there offering term insurance, you're taking that out. We consider that to be direct insurance as well in our definition. Obviously, we're excluding advisor business, and we're also excluding group business in our definition. So who's who in the direct market? Now, this is actually quite difficult to come up with a definitive answer because there's not actually any definitive statistics on the market. Although we have looked at the Plan for Life figures, this was one source, and they compile statistics on the volume of sales. And in this particular chart here, what I've done is the volume of inflows for the 12 months leading up to September 2009. Now, very quickly, we can see that there's only four groups which are making up over two-thirds of the market: the Tower Group, Cominsure, AMP, and BT Westpac. This is when we're looking at inflows. I must admit, if I change this around and looking at the sales in the previous year, you get a slightly different mix at the top. This is likely coming out of our experience of the direct market is, generally speaking, from our own involvement in this, is where people generally don't have a large book of in-force policies or a large financial advisor base, and they're trying to build contact customers through alternative means. Now, that doesn't usually wash what we're looking at above, so that kind of tells us that these companies are possibly selling direct business through most likely through probably debt insurance, where the products aren't actually in the open market. Some of these companies definitely rely heavily on their financial advisors, and they don't want to disrupt that. From our own observations in the direct market space, what we found to be the active insurers is Allianz, Tower, Zurich, AIA, MetLife, Hallmark, St. Andrews, and Kuna Mutual. Now, apologies if there's somebody else here who is from a company who actually is involved in direct marketing, but we haven't mentioned. So the reality is that you can only actually go on the statistics that you see, and if we haven't been targeted by a company, we don't know that they're out there. So there could well be somebody else who's working in this, but not necessarily mentioned in our slides here. Now, in addition to the issuers of the or the people who chase up direct distribution as a possible distribution channel, there's other players in the channel as well, and this is where there's a scope for outsourcing or specialisation of certain parts of the bringing a product to the customer, but not necessarily doing every component. For example, Real Insurance and ALI are both companies which are involved in the product design and the distribution and even the pricing administration of the policies, but they actually don't tend to hold the risk themselves. Well, they're not insurance companies. So the insurance tends to be issued by an established company, St. Andrews, AIA, Tower and Hanover have been involved in this, and they all have in-force policies which are administered by Real Insurance, ALI. So, what is direct marketing? There's a few different ways that we can sell these policies. I'm going to go through some of them now. Probably the most common and the most popular is direct mail. Under this method, typically the provider will send out a letter to somebody, probably with a PDS, a letter explaining how you can apply for the policy, and maybe there'll be an application form in there, maybe explaining how to apply for the policy, either filling the application form, go to a website, or phone them up. The policies the organisations issuing this tend to be affiliated to some sort of an existing relationship. So it might be a bank contacting their customers who recently took out a credit card, asked them do they want to take out some consumer credit insurance on their credit card. Some automobile clubs will also contact their own customers just offering life insurance. Credit unions will do the same. So there tends to be an existing customer base. What we've noticed as being what we think might be success factors in this, the costs are fairly uniform per customer that you're contacting. So it's very important that when you contact somebody that they take out a policy. If you're contacting 2,000 people, you hope to make as many sales as you can. If you're contacting 4,000, you're hoping to at least increase your sale rate. There's no point in contacting everybody you know because not many people are going to actually take out a policy. So this trick is to get the balance right and contact the people who are most susceptible to taking one out. The relationship to the organisation is also important. If you believe the popular media, then a lot of people don't like banks. So maybe why would they buy an insurance policy from a bank? But having said that, other brands are, for example, if you take your frequent flyer program, you might have a lot of loyalty towards them, but if they start offering you term insurance, you might think, no, this is something I should get from my financial institution, my bank or something. You're not going to buy it from Qantas because they start mailing you all of a sudden. The other thing to keep in mind is there's obviously a priority in the mailing queue. Everybody wants to contact the customers and sell them something. So if you want to make your product successful, you have to fit your pamphlet in there and make sure it's being read but not overloading the customer. Direct mail can also involve telemarketing in some respect. So the initial letter might instead say somebody's going to call you at a certain point and speak to you more about this type of product. In this situation, the staff quality is much more important because the training of the staff is actually what makes the sale. Even it can come down to what time of day do they call, what sort of mood are they in. These things are important. As well for the call centres, they want to make sure If they can issue the policy on the spot, it makes it a lot easier for the sale to take place. If the person on the other end of the line is saying, okay, that's great, you want to make a call, you want to buy a policy, I'll send you the form might go missing. So if you can sell the policy on the spot, then they're much more likely to succeed. Advertised call to direct action. This is a sort of thing that you're probably all familiar with in some way or other. Generally speaking, you're advertising for insurance to be taken out, typically with the intention that they're going to take it out at the end rather than contact or be referred to a financial advisor. So I don't know who's seen daytime TV recently, but not surprisingly, there's quite a few, quite a lot of advertising of insurance to retirees, like funeral cover, on the television. It typically goes, what would happen if you died and your funeral expenses had not been provided for? It's not just TV. I mean, you can get this on newspapers as well, post-it notes stuck to newspapers, this sort of thing. But generally, it's asking you to come and contact a call centre or something and take out the cover. It's our experience that direct response TV is the most successful in this respect, and Real Insurance and Insurance Line are two examples which have been very successful, I believe, in attracting and making this channel successful. Effective advertising to the appropriate audience is obviously key here, because you want to be contacting the customers who are most likely to take out the policy. So as I say, advertising to retirees during the day versus, well, I don't work in advertising, but obviously this is the thing to strike right. When somebody does finally call up, you again want to make sure that you can issue their policy on the spot. So having a direct fulfillment system in place where you can, if necessary, do underwriting or worst case scenario to turn them down, but ideally to get back to them at some point. But if you can issue the policy on the spot, then you're going to be much more successful in this respect. I think it's fair to say that the internet has probably disappointed a lot of people in terms of sales over the past 10 years, well, the Y2K bubble. We spoke to one actuary when we were compiling our research who had designed and implemented a system for... it had an underwriting engine and application process all online. He always knew that insurance was sold and it wasn't bought, but he never realised the extent of that until he put this system in place and realised that nobody was taking out the insurance. As part of our research, we did a Google search and typed in term life and term insurance to see what sort of things come up. Not surprisingly, we came across plenty of insurers' presence on the internet, but not necessarily actually offering insurance directly from their websites, although a few of them did. We also had a number of broker comparison sites. These typically give a list of insurers, a panel of insurers, and the quotations from each system, and you can click on a specific one which might meet your needs the best, gives you the lowest quote or whatever you want, and it takes you to their website, or else might actually put you in touch with a financial advisor in respect to that. So not surprisingly, with the internet sales, success really depends on the ability to generate web traffic. So it's no point in having a wonderful website if no one's actually looking at it. We probably have one example of this, is where Once Online or Once Life is a website which, in our opinion, is an excellent website. It has a series of underwriting questions that it'll take you through, and it'll even apply some premium loadings and offer you a policy on the spot. Unfortunately, it doesn't really get noticed on the search engines, and for that reason it hasn't reached its full potential, in our opinion. The other difficulty is, or the other important thing to consider, is that just because somebody's looking at your site doesn't mean that they're going to take out the insurance or the appropriate level of insurance. So it's useful to be able to demonstrate the need for insurance online. So a simple needs-based calculator could resolve this. And as usual, an on-the-spot underwriting and policy issue system is very helpful here. Once you have them and they're about to buy the policy, if you turn them back and say, you now need to fill in this form, you're possibly going to lose the customer. It's also interesting to think about what might happen in the future with the increase of Generation Y and also the rollout of the National Broadband Network, what opportunities this might make for the internet going forwards. Debt insurance. it's probably self-explanatory, I think, but this is where you've got a product which is specifically designed to cover the risk of not meeting your debt obligations. Now, this might mean meeting the regular repayments, or if you're out of work, or if you're sick for a little while, or else covering the loan entirely if for some reason you become, if you die, the worst case scenario, or if you become totally and permanently disabled. So a typical policy in this situation might be a mortgage protection product, which I've listed here as might be a full stream of benefits, would be death cover, TPD, accident, sickness, unemployment, and you can scale that down if you want a cheaper version of the product. The products themselves are typically written under consumer credit insurance legislation, but they don't have to be in that respect. Consumer credit insurance means that the actual policy is actually tied to the loan itself, and that means that when the loan is refinanced or cancelled in some way, the policy has to cancel, so it has some impact on the lapses. There's also an impact on the commission for consumer credit insurance, where there's a cap of 20% in place. So in our view, I think the critical success, or the some of the success for this type of product depends on a clear sales process and training. So when somebody is taking out a mortgage or a loan, the salesperson has a really captive audience here, because the immediately creating a need for insurance, as long as you can present them with a product which covers, with the benefits that covers their needs, then I think you're a lot of the way there towards making a successful sale. Obviously, the person has to believe in the product to make it attractive, and they need to be supported by the bank itself or whatever it may be, the lending institution. There's no point in having a financial advisor in the store if the person is trying to sell a consumer credit insurance policy, or should I direct this instead to the financial advisor and let them look after their insurance needs? The most successful channels are when there's fewer conflicts, and because the captive audience is there, the benefits is more important than the price. It may be the case that these things aren't always price competitive because of that very reason. So what's different about direct products instead of advisor-sold products? Ultimately, they still cover you for insurance in some way or other, but because the direct products typically are sold with no advice, there's not really as much room for the bells and whistles that you might find on the advisor-sold products. In our opinion, the most successful direct products are a lot simpler, so they have straightforward benefits, simple premium rate structure, and generally minimal underwriting. So even to the extent that there might be no premium rate, the only question you might ask are you male or female? And some consumer credit insurance policies have a flat premium rate, so they don't even ask any premium rating factors. There'll be perhaps a pre-existing conditions exclusion, and that's the extent of I won't say the extent of risk management, but that's probably the only extent of underwriting in the product. The products tend to price, because of this lack of underwriting or reduction in underwriting, not necessarily lack of underwriting, compared to the advisor-sold products, they end up pricing for an average policyholder rather than where an advisor-sold product might have a price more appropriate for a healthy person, and then if they're not healthy, you can put the loadings on afterwards. This can maybe make them perceived as being more expensive, but I suppose it depends on which part of the market you're looking at. The automatic acceptance of cover, it's quite often, as I say, with consumer credit insurance, where provided they have no pre-existing conditions, that they're all going to be automatically accepted for the cover. Finally, part of our research as well, we looked at what was happening abroad in the direct market space, and probably not surprising, we found that there weren't any overseas markets where direct channels was much greater than the traditional channels. So it's fairly typical with Australia, where the direct is still a small part of the market, but in our opinion also an important part. But we did see some very interesting different distribution methods that don't necessarily exist in Australia or not to the same extent. I'll go through a few of these now. Kiosk sales, this is where these kiosks can exist at various locations, basically contacting customers that might not have their own financial advisor. And for example, you might have kiosks at seaports or bus terminals or some airports offering travel insurance. We saw some kiosks in hospitals offering health insurance. Not sure if that's a good idea. But there's a variety of ways that these are being used in Asia, mainly because the financial advice network isn't possibly as strong over there as it is over here, and they want some other way of getting these products out there, but there's no reason why this might not work in Australia. Also because we're fairly technologically advanced over here, I think people are comfortable with computers and might be successful. SMSs are also used in some countries where an issuer might send an SMS and suggest, provide details of an insurance policy and gives the person an opportunity to respond and say, you'd like more details, you'd like a quote, you'd like somebody to call you and discuss it further. In Ireland and the UK, for some time now, you've been able to get life insurance through a supermarket. Doesn't seem to happen over here. I don't see why. It could be a very simple product to offer. The internet always had a place, I suppose, throughout the world. One of the things I noted about the affinity groups was in the US in particular, through the direct marketing channel, they found that they were able to use data analytics to analyse huge consumer databases and to find out which customers are most likely to take out the insurance, and they were able to use this to significantly increase their strike rates and make them much more profitable. I'll now hand you over to Wayne, who's going to talk about the consumer's point of view and insurance point of view for underinsurance.
Thanks, John. Yeah, look, I must admit I was disappointed. I was hoping to bring you some kind of blunt and insight from somewhere in the world where direct markets were just the channel for selling life insurance, but what we found out is that this doesn't happen anywhere, and that's probably quite telling. That's not a sort of a failure of innovation in Australia. It's just it's a fundamental issue that while there's all this promise of direct markets, they're just not the dominant channel anywhere yet. Interesting on the affinity groups, John. I would have thought, I know Woolworths knows an awful lot of things about me, for my card, and you send me mostly nappies and stuff like that. Offers around nappies and fresh fruit. So maybe that'll be life insurance. They'll attach the nappies and the life insurance. Okay, so getting down to answering the question, is direct helping life insurers to address underinsurance, particularly this next minute or two, or the next slide or two, is looking to see whether or not direct channels are allowing life insurers to profitably, keyword, profitably access consumers that they wouldn't otherwise, or to profitably increase customers' levels of insurance beyond that they otherwise would. So are we getting, you know, is it working for the life insurers? And I guess the two ways of looking at that are, those top two there are really a sales measure. Are they getting volume? Second one, is it profitable? And we've got some insights on that, which we'll take you through. John covered off this slide before, or a similar slide. As you can see, direct, whether it's by inflows or sales, and I think John put, which one did he use before?
Inflows
before. So as he said, sales is a bit of a different measure, clearly because there's less of a back book of direct business, that inflows are more, sales more highly rates the direct share, but still it's 13% or 8%. It's just not a lot either way. By sales, the rest of that pie, 51% for advisors and 35% for group. And as you can see, that's for Plan for Life. The interesting thing, and we just in using Plan for Life direct data, I don't know how many of you are involved in submitting Plan for Life data, but the bit by channel is a fairly miscellaneous bit on the Plan for Life submission, I suspect. Direct here comes from direct another. We know that it excludes some consumer credit and related debt insurance. It also excludes business that is like direct business that's sold by general insurers. There's a lot of general insurers who sell accidental death or death cover for small sums insured, and they sell that directly, but it's obviously not in the Plan for Life data. And I know from first-hand experience that there's some insurers have trouble splitting their sales by channel. Another attempt at identifying sort of this last point is who's showing some volumes through Plan for Life, but also who's it important for. So I identified the companies that both where they had more than 10 million of GWP in direct channels, but also where it was more than 20% of their GWP. So it was important to the insurer, and the insurer was important in the market, in the direct space, which gives you a list there of Tower, BT, Tower obviously through insurance line, BT, Hallmark is a consumer credit insurer mostly, Allianz and Macquarie. Again, I'd note that's imperfect. My employer, St Andrews, should have been on there, but obviously we didn't fill the forms in for Plan for Life correctly. So from a top-down view, How big is direct? How far is it getting into the market? Not that big just yet. From a bottom-up view, what can individual insurance companies achieve? And the way I guess we're looking at that is by strike rates. Now, on strike rates, typically a strike rate is sort of a number of lives insured or a number of policies divided by basically the number of things you sell out, or you send out. So if you send out a mail, you send out 100,000 mail packs and you get back 1,000 policies, well, there's a 1% strike rate. But that's the typical measure in these kinds of channels. You can only really use that in the active selling channels. So in the direct market and all the sub-channels, as John defined, there are active channels, so your direct mail, or your consumer credit, or those kinds of things, where you're presented with an opportunity to sell to somebody and you want to try and convert that sale. There's also more passive selling, which is I'll put it out on the internet and hope somebody comes, or I'll advertise and hope somebody comes. Now, it's obviously harder to measure a strike rate on your internet sales, although you wouldn't even be measuring things like, you know, how many people came to your website and how many went through each step of the process and how many did you actually get at the other end of the funnel with a sale completed. I like to think that strike rates are a demonstration of perceived value. Basically that, you know, when somebody is presented, I'm about to move on to a consumer credit example. I'm sitting there, I'm taking out a mortgage, somebody says, you know, are you comfortable with your insurance needs? What would you do if you lost your job? How would you repay your mortgage? In that example, there's a perceived, it's very easy for the salesperson to demonstrate a need, and the strike rates, if they're reasonable, would demonstrate that the consumer themselves perceives a need at that point in time. Now, the consumer credit industry gets in a bit of trouble. These are strike rates from my own personal experience. If St Andrews was pitching business to you, that's the kind of strike rates we'd tell you should be achieving. So to take on the example of the personal loans, we'd say that from every 10 personal loans you write, we can get 6 of them insured, 60%. If nothing else, the people taking out those personal loans, when assisted by the sales process, are perceiving an unmet insurance need and they're protecting it. So mortgages, 40%, they're bigger debts, they're bigger premiums. That's why it's lower. I guess particularly in personal loans too, people who take out personal loans tend not to have much other insurance because they're taking out loans to buy cars and things. They haven't got a lot behind them. They're younger. It's easier for them to perceive that need and say, a typical benefit of a consumer credit product would also be accident, sickness cover and unemployment cover. People are worried about, well, I need that car for a losable job, so let's insure that. Other strike rates we've observed in some of those other active sub-channels. Direct mail, look, you can shotgun direct mail and get somewhere around 1% if you've got a reasonable brochure. You can just send it, if you've got a million names and you send it to all million, you can get around 1%. Not all the time, particularly if you've mailed that database before, and I've seen databases that have been mailed about 14 times over the years, and you can see those strike rates really dropping because someone goes, I've been offered that before and I didn't take it out last time. But with a bit of propensity modelling, you really should be getting 1% plus. The follow-up phone call, and that personally interests me, and John did sort of cover off that. When you're doing direct mail, but rather than just sending out, I know I've done direct mail with one pack, I've done direct mail where we do two packs, and we send you a reminder letter 3 weeks' time. really good strike rates is when you send out a brochure, and then 2 weeks or a week later, call them. Say, hey, I was just wondering if you'd read that brochure. Either they've already dismissed it or they go, yeah, I was thinking about that. And the call centre staff and have the systems and training to actually convert that to a sale, take them through underwriting and issue the policy on the spot. Now, if you've got all that set up, then you can get some good strike rates. I'm saying 5 to 10. I was involved in, and John was involved in as well, in a trial that got 5 to 6 at the early trial stages. So I would have thought you should be able to get 10 fairly easily. But propensity modelling is required for efficiency. I mentioned before the example of mailing a million people. I know no one much has heard of St Andrews Life Insurance, but in 2006 we mailed over 1 million Australians, which was an awful lot of people, and we basically burned the names, I would have thought, in hindsight. We're not going to get access to 1 million names all that often. And we didn't get enough policies out of those 1 million names. It's just not. If you need to do propensity modelling to target your customers to efficiently use that value you've got, which is the customer base of the list of names. We still made money on all those campaigns, but it wasn't an efficient use of the resource. Insights on profitability, funnily enough, closely guarded. We asked lots of people and no one told us. But I think there's some reasonable inferences you can make. And there's some anecdotal evidence I can provide. I think it's reasonable to conclude that anything that's sustained over a long period of time is profitable. You know, it exceeds performance hurdles. Anything that you've observed a company doing for 5 years, rather than banging their head against the wall, it actually is working for them. So in that context, I think the channels I can put into that category is direct mail. Yeah, direct mail is profitable. Mightn't set anyone's world on fire, but it's profitable. Direct mail with a telephone call up is profitable. That direct response TV, like Real Life Insurance and Insurance Line, they're spending a lot of money. It must be making something back. And they've been doing it for a while, so I can only conclude that they're doing it well. Another example from Consumer Credit. So this is industry data for the 6 months to June 2009 in the general insurance industry. So I know life insurers don't share any information on profitability. General insurers have to, and it comes out in APRA forms, and you can go to the APRA website and find out what the general insurance loss ratios were on various things and how much money each company made. The consumer credit industry via general insurance as a whole for that 6 months had a loss ratio of 22%. They have a commission cap of 20%. They had 58% left over for expenses, margins, and capital cost. And that 6 months to June 2009 was actually when we had our mini recession, or whatever you want to call it, in hindsight. So actually that would have been a high point for loss ratios for a lot of those businesses. I know it was for mine. Overall, by comparison, overall the loss ratio for the general insurance industry is 76% for that period. Observations on other sub-channels, internet. Look, we didn't have a lot to offer. We didn't get any first-hand knowledge, but it makes sense. It's a scale game, and what you need is cost-effective web traffic. Point of sale, in our experience, so this point of sale by here, I mean, having brochures in bank branches and your health insurers' offices or any of those kinds of things, walking into somewhere, I know we've done it with RACV, so walking into RACV being the Victorian NRMA, walking into the office and having life insurance brochures on the counter. My view is the point of sale is marginally profitable if it's fully costed. Quite often, though, it's not fully costed, and the insurance company will pay a commission of 20%, 30% to the people operating the stores, and I suspect there's actually a distribution loss being made at that end of that part of the supply chain. But when it's fully costed and you actually have to pay the costs of all that, my experience is it's fairly marginal, because in the Australian compliance environment, people in those bank branches, those health insurance stores or the automobile clubs, they can't actively sell the product. They can't sit down and try and sell life insurance to you. They're not allowed to do it because they can't start explaining the needs. So in summary, is direct helping life insurers to address underinsurance? And I will start speeding up so I know it's the time. Yes. Though insufficient, the volumes are insufficient really to materially solve underinsurance. It's a niche at the moment, hopefully it grows, but that market share says it's not making a huge impact. Clearly, strike rates demonstrate ability to access new customers and to upsell, and it can be profitable. So is it helping life insurers to address underinsurance? Yes, but probably not to solve underinsurance. We'll take a similar view on the customers. Looking to see whether it helps customers to address underinsurance, we're looking to address or to consider, does it improve access? Are the typical products adequate and do they meet the needs? And finally, what's the impact of the absence of advice? Because clearly if you're buying your life insurance off the internet, you didn't get any financial advice on that. Does it improve access to life insurance? Well, yeah, basically, if I can move through that quickly, if you've got more options and more ways to access, there will be some people who didn't want to access it via an advisor who are happy doing it on the internet or from their bank manager or from that direct mail from that company that they trust. So it does actually, almost by definition, improve access for some people. Do the products meet the needs? So I went to the LifeWise website. IFS Alive website, which is obviously a campaign via IFSA to promote the needs, promote the need for life insurance. And what I actually did there was I got Mr. and Mrs. Average and used this website to assess their insurance needs, and then I went to try and buy that insurance online. So here's a picture of Mrs. Average and their oldest son from the LifeWise website. And look, they are literally average. I could go through all the stats, but basically there's average mortgage, average average household income, both age 35, don't smoke. I tried to make them as typical as I possibly could. Details are in the paper. So based upon a household income of about $100,000 and a mortgage of $300,000, the IFSA website told me that Mr. Average needed $1.47 million of life cover and $3,900 of DII. Mrs. Average needed $900,000 of life cover. To be honest, that seems a bit high to me, but that's what the website, that's what the calculator suggested. That's combined, you know, for Mr. Average, it's more like 20 times his salary than 10 times. But that's what we're promoting as an industry. So based upon that, Mr. and Mrs. Average went to seek online cover. They decided to get TPD as well, so they were looking for death and TPD in those volumes and income protection. And could I find that online? Not surprisingly, no. If I run through a couple of examples, I got close on a couple of websites. Allianz, credit to anyone who's here from Allianz. Allianz provides much higher maximum sums insured online than most other companies. So I could have got the 1.47 of death cover, but I could only get 1.25 of TPD, and I couldn't get income protection online. So then I moved on to Insurance Line. I got a million of term life and TPD there, but they could get the income protection. So I'm getting there, but I can't get Mr. Average's sums insured. I went to MBF. Actually, I went through all the websites I could find. I mentioned the ones that got close. MBF did actually offer term life online and TPD and income protection, all with the right adequate cover levels. So that was looking really good. And then I got to the button that says, "Oh, to apply, please click here and download the application form." But no, too busy, not going to do it. So they had the products, but they weren't really selling them online. Maybe they were selling it online, but they weren't applying for it online. It was a half a process. So fundamentally, my consumer test of can I actually go and buy life insurance for these people online was no, to which I can only say we all need to do some more product development. Finally, just looking at the consumer's point of view, what's the impact of the absence of advice in direct channels? To be honest, it's very hard to sort of give any advice given the compliance regime in Australia. Compare that to the UK, and I know in one of the earlier sessions I was in, people were talking about what could happen as a polarisation. If you put in commission bans and things, you end up with a polarisation of the market, which is there's people who are clearly independent and there's people who are clearly product floggers, and there's not the blurred line in between. I know in the UK there are clearly people in bank branches and things who can flog product and do. And so in that kind of direct channel, they are really able to demonstrate a need and sell. And that really you just can't quite do under FSRA, I think, in Australia. Which I only think could really, you know, contribute to under... We would think that the absence of advice would contribute to under-assessment of insurance needs. Even if people are buying insurance via these channels, they're probably not buying enough without the need being suitably demonstrated and explained. So, in summary, is direct helping consumers to address their underinsurance? Yes, though imperfectly. So, wrapping up, and this is the final slide, is direct helping us, Australia, to address underinsurance? That was actually not really was the first two words in the paper, and I think it's a good way to conclude. No, not really. There's potential there. You think the technology's there, the processes are there, but there's not enough market share. So if you look at the data, you'd have to say it's not really making a huge impact yet. If the market share, you know, of inflows is 8.5%, it's not particularly material. However, it can be quite successful for individual insurers as a way to grow scale and as a way to access when you haven't got much of an advisor force or much of a network that way. And we've clearly seen the degree of success varies by method. Some are more successful than others, clearly. Some very successful. It does allow insurers to access new profitable customers, although, again, how many? It allows the consumers better access to products, but that may only partly meet their need. And right at the end here, I thought, well, what was missing? So we posed the question in the paper, really. We started off on our journey of asking this question on a premise that advisors weren't going to be the answer to underinsurance, because advisors are unlikely to, given their current remuneration models, want to go and deal with people who are 30, 40, don't have much in the way of accumulated income, and maybe have fairly basic insurance needs, because they can't get given the current remuneration models, they just can't make acquitted out of doing that. So was direct going to be the answer? The answer we've come up with is we're not so sure, and maybe someone should research the role of group risk in this. And I think that'd be a good topic for future research. So sorry we have taken a fair bit of time, but I'll hand over to Peter for Q&A.
Got about 10 minutes, I think, for questions, so we'll just do the usual process. We've got the roving mic, and if you just state your name before you answer the question, who'd like to go first? We've got one.
Michael O'Neill from Investors Mutual. You talked about in the direct channel it's important, and there are some examples where you get good customer analytics and maybe you can do some underwriting. And that's important given the way you're selling this. Seems to me that there's one underutilized channel, which is health, and we've only really got two very early stage examples of health being used for more direct customer engagement. I just wonder if you think that's a natural fit and how that model might work.
Is health insurance?
Yes.
Yeah, it wasn't something we had considered an awful lot. Somebody else has already picked me up on that today. Obviously it is a natural fit in terms of the penetration rates of health insurance are, I think, better than the penetration rates on life insurance. Tend to be higher probably in younger ages. People who have young families probably tend to have some higher levels of health insurance, so there would seem to be some kind of natural fit there.
Hi, David Goodsall from Singer Noble. Wayne and John, thank you very much for taking us through the position of direct insurance, but also picking up the issue about underinsurance, because as a profession I think we need to get involved in this debate and find ways of fixing it. A couple of observations about direct insurance. We need to be very careful that we do it properly. A lot of people say, Fred down the road's doing it, so I'll do it as well. I know one company that's in the direct response TV and just keeps pouring money down the drain because they don't know how to do it. It took insurance lines something like 7 to 8 years to work out how to do it properly. So we need to be mindful of those areas. Internet, interesting example. One company had a website that got a lot of e-commerce traffic through it, and they spent $25,000 setting up a facility to take out life insurance, put a link on their home page, and they were writing about 8 policies a week for $25,000. So it comes down to generate the web traffic. Which then takes us through to the once example where you mentioned a really good process in the website. I'm sure they won't mind me saying that business model depended on them spending tens of millions of dollars on marketing to get that web traffic through, and for various reasons they chose to put their capital elsewhere and that didn't happen. So a lost opportunity there. The propensity modelling, the efficiency is very important, and this is where we as actuaries can really add value, but we have to educate ourselves and be skilled up. Hands up those who know anything about propensity modelling. Okay, it's not very many. I was talking to the head of fundraising at the Exodus Foundation the other day, and what he knows about propensity modelling and targeting and use of demographics and mailing lists was mind-blowing. He's not a technical person at all. But there are people out there doing this sort of thing regularly. Insurance industry does it very badly. We as a profession have the ability to advise on that, but we do need to skill ourselves up. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in this field, to actually go out and see what's happening out there. The the advertisers, fundraisers, many people are doing things. There are some terrific tools out there. I actually applied some of these tools to one particular mailing list and found that if you change your parameters for identifying how your targeting works, you could reduce your mailings by 70%, but only reduce your take-up by 10%. So you weren't going to write huge, you'd write less business, but you'd do it much, much more profitably. And if we can bring those sort of things to the table, that will generate the ability to fund the research and development of this type of thing so we can actually get down to solving this under insurance problem. And I do have one quick question. The Swiss Re numbers, were they comparing like with like, or was there a significant investment component in the overseas business which would help explain why Australia was low?
A quick answer is I don't know. I assume that they were like with like, but I left it to their experience too. I took their results rather than check their study.
There was one here somewhere, was it?
Yes. Patricia Berry, Swiss Re. Not that I'm going to answer the question about the Swiss Re numbers. But I do agree that I remember the Sigma publication. They give the same message that compared to other countries, Australia had a relatively higher level of insurance.
We got a response saying yes, it does.
Anyway, my question's about price. When you looked at whether it's a good deal for Mr. and Mrs. FH, what considerations did you give to the value for money for direct marketing, you know, versus advisors group? And following on from that, how price sensitive are the consumers in this type of direct channel? I mean, I do hear a lot of people saying, oh, you know, they can't easily compare, but can you give us more insight to that, please?
Sure, Patricia. Look, obviously, we didn't attempt. We looked at whether they met the needs and sort of left it at that. There is a paper around, I think it was a Rice Warner paper, that looked at, compared the profits of the premium rates for direct products to equivalent non-direct products, and generally concluded they were around about the same price or slightly more expensive, the direct products, which I think goes to John's comment. You would initially, I might have thought, well, hang on, there's not so much commission, so they should be cheaper, but the reality is the acquisition delivery methods are still quite expensive, and you're doing less underwriting, so you actually need a higher risk premium. They are certainly no cheaper. Consumer credit insurance, which I used examples of high strike rates, is clearly expensive given those loss ratios. So the second part of your question was price sensitivity. So it depends upon the channel. I would have thought internet would be quite, just logically, internet would be quite price sensitive because people can easily shop around on the internet. If you've got a captive audience, my experience is no, it's not very price sensitive. But it's more important to demonstrate that the product will meet the person's insurance needs and just to be perceived as good benefits than cheap.
Chris Johnson, Trinary Consulting. Do you think the size of the group risk market in Australia affects the size of the direct market? So the larger the group risk market, the smaller the direct market?
In short, it makes sense. I mean, clearly there's a contribution of the group risk market both to a larger number of people having a basic level of cover, but also to under insurance, and then a large number of people have default cover and think that they're fine with default cover.
I think we're nearly out of time. We've got probably one more here.
Phil Amps from NAB. Just interested in the consumers and the attrition. Do you see it as a first step into full advice, or is it customers who are never going to go into full advice who go into direct?
That's a good question, Phil. I know I've certainly seen in some channels, and John touched on channel conflict in saying consumer credit, where I've certainly seen where people will, where the lender will sell a consumer credit policy over a new mortgage to get the person insured, and then we'll still refer them onto the advisor that's around the corner. Is it a first step? Look, it probably depends upon the particular insurer's needs. If the products generally are slightly more expensive, do you actually want to unsell that person?
Okay, one more.
Richard Lyon. The question was asked about value. My limited knowledge of this market is that value isn't the issue with direct. It is the exact pure sales environment. If you establish the need and the cost is not too high, value doesn't come into it. And that's why the direct marketing piece of paper that comes with your Amex bill or whatever, why it works. And the reason why it doesn't work is not because of that, but because of the rules that stop you saying, this is something you need, buy it now. And that's why Australian direct mail response rates are so much worse than say, Asia.
Thanks for that, Richard. Yeah, I would certainly say, look, in terms of a value for money scale, and probably it goes back to Phil's question, clearly, yeah, as we mentioned before, a lot of people have default cover. Buying $500,000 of term life insurance is possibly an interim step in terms of getting yourself properly covered. There are always people, and you know, it would be great, obviously, from under an insurance point of view, if everyone could see an advisor and get their needs adequately met. But we know that's not going to be the case. So I think there's roles for direct, for group, and for advice to meet the needs as best as possible for certain customer segments.
Right, I think we're out of time, so we'll just thank John and Wayne for a thought-provoking discussion there, and we'll thank him in the usual way.